don't know.
You haven't gone on a single sabbatical.
Sick with, yeah. I remember migraines over the past couple weeks, so I was, I've been away from my computer.
Well, that's good for you, but not so good in the physical, actually headache part, but like getting away from the computer is nice.
Yes. So anyways, I'm telling you, I'm a little bit behind on emails, but.
He was just there, he could Bob, I think.
Gee, how are you?
I think we just there because we wanted to have Ryan.
So the context behind that is.
Hi.
I'm hoping to write a resolution that basically is a priority recommendation about the campus circulator. And the CPC has been looking at a way to like act more like a committee of the assembly. And so that to me felt like, hey, there's two things. We can make a recommendation. And then I've talked to.
Absolutely. That is my recommendation. Sounds very easily.
Okay, because that was one of those things where I talked to the EA, they're interested in supporting. She also told me the SA has more of that. Rena is on board as long as I get transportation.
I am.
I realized looking at
so you're free to join the other table, or I'd like to be broken with you.
Oh, how are you?
I'm going to say yes to you.
Please feel free to join us if you'd like in your freshman or anything. Please put it down.
Oh, okay.
Yes, they have flatbreads, so that's
some vegan wings, which are vegan wings. So. But yeah, it is all good.
Over here, good, right here.
Absolutely, yes. The place will be your first time.
Al, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
No, it's painfully because I'm not in the stuff. I feel like when you need.
We didn't want to ambush you. By the way, congratulations.
Bye, Kathy. Hello.
Hello, Dave. Yes, exactly. I know when we talk, understandably, it's all of a sudden, more of those items, things that accumulate, or they and I think it'll be a great opportunity.
Mostly, I wanted to just let you know the idea.
Bring it started.
Once I have something that person resolution, we're able to
answer questions.
Like a ten-minute audience. I'd like to bring more. I or somebody at the faculty center.
There's lots of questions.
Stephen Wolf is the faculty
member.
Chair of the PC.
I think your percentage is going to be a lot of really crazy.
Charlie.
I was like, okay. I know. Unfortunately, we haven't even video, but Yeah, it's very yeah, well, that
being said, I don't have money to drink yet.
It's one of those things you can drown yourself.
You want some of that boldness, you want it to go on like 3 to 5 years.
That's actually cool.
Thanks.
Exactly.
Help us keep one door.
Yeah, we're not very
good.
Some of the meetings are going to carve or
the like happy that we're almost possibly
exactly yes.
Well, what's up? So,
triage.
Let you go.
Yeah.
Oh, that means I have to show you pictures of my cats.
Yes, you do. How many do you have?
Two.
One that wasn't on the list
of well, not so, okay. Yeah, they were kittens like Christmas time.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
How are you? SBC, yeah.
Well,
so the brother and sister,
but
they're a mix. So they have a little bit of a
name.
So they have a lot of names. He's like, he's only 6 months old. He's already close to 11 pounds. And he's the little one. But it's fun to watch. You know, we used to have one cat, and he died. He's like,
yeah.
But then we thought, we've always read that getting two is good because they keep it to the company. And that's true.
Yeah.
But they're really fun to watch together. You know, how
yeah.
They, you know, they, first of all, they wrestled all the time, you know.
If I could go back, I would have adopted one of my siblings. But it's probably better not. She's already
so I'm not going to be.
What did your other cat
look like? I was a little gray cat. Well, I can't.
David, are you still on the discovery message or mission from your retiree that left you? It's like a developer that left you from the city. Starting
to know. Something always pops up. You're like, oh crap, how did you do that? Special policy. Things have kind of calmed down. Well,
cute
and relatively.
This was, you know, the first, they never knew what outdoors was.
Oh my gosh, they are so much fuzzier than I even expected.
Yeah. He's I'll show you a recipe. Yeah, but they're very, you know, they find it, but then they're, you know, the ball doesn't have most of the time.
So here's
that's the way they think about it. So he's looking at out of the blue. You know, that's what goes on. So now it's like 20 pounds of fur leaving that floor. If you haven't had they'll be a profit. So we're getting him used to brushing.
Good afternoon, everybody.
He's going to be a high meeting.
Time is 4:31. I'm going to call this meeting the University Assembly to order. We are very pleased to be joined by the Chief of Cornell Police, Dave Honan, as well as Ted Sheely and Leslie Meyerhoff for a discussion about tobacco later in the meeting. Given that we have a number of guests here, I'm going to ask if there's any dissent to jumping right into presentations. Seeing none, on behalf of the Assembly, I am very pleased to welcome Dave Honan.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm honored that I was asked to come and speak and introduce myself. I know a couple of you from previous interactions on campus, but I'm glad to meet the rest of you. Again, I'm Dave Honan. I was deputy chief of the Cornell Police for quite a few years under Kathy Zoner. I've been at Cornell Police for almost 24 years, in about 2 weeks, it'll be my 24th anniversary. Cornell was my 2-year stop. So I was going to come here, you know, learn how to be a cop. And, you know, I'm originally from Rochester, New York. So I thought I was going to return to Rochester and be a cop there. One thing led to another. I got promoted. Cornell is a very good place to work. By the time I had other opportunities, I kind of found a home here. Cornell, I found just to be a great community, great connection, and some place I wanted to stay. So when the other opportunities came up, here I am. Never thought that it would be this. My whole goal was to be a sergeant. And I didn't really plan much beyond that. And everything just kind of happened. And here I am. So I originally came to Ithaca as a music major at Ithaca College. Found out that music education was probably not my passion, and law enforcement was. So I did spend 4 years in my undergrad as an Ithaca College student, left, came back to Cornell, and I've been here ever since. So recently, taken over as chief of police, I've been asked a lot about, you know, what are you doing? Where are you headed? One good thing about what I inherited from Kathy is we have a very good police department, and we function at a very high level. We have a great relationship with our community, and I'm going to just reset that our mission remains the same. And if anybody doesn't know what our mission is, it's service. So sometimes police departments have a mission of serve and protect. We believe protect is just a natural part of service. But we make it just service because it is just that much bigger. That is the primary mission of our department, is to connect people with resources. If those resources are criminal enforcement, hey, we're the guys, we're here to help you. If the resources are victims advocacy, sometimes the resources are a 911 call to our 911 center that my pipe is leaking in my room. So we connect them to facilities. Sometimes it's a light is on. So we do a pretty broad spectrum. If it's not us, we're the we like to be the people to help connect people to the services. Part of service is also being engaged in the community. We have a community policing, a crime prevention office. But one thing that I've always loved about the way we function here at the Cornell Police is every single officer is a community police officer. So if you don't want to be a community police officer, think that being a cop is something different, this probably is not the place for you to work. You know, you're working in a university environment, and when you're working in this environment, I like to say that we're far ahead of some of the municipal law enforcement agencies. They're starting to do now what we've been doing for 20, 30, 40 years. So every officer engaged in the community, and if anybody here were to find something different from one of my staff, that's something I would certainly would love to hear about. One part of being a police department in an Ivy League institution, I think, is that we do hold ourselves to a higher standard. One of the things I'm really proud of, in addition to our service to the community, is our training. I would put our training up to any agency in this part of the state. I believe that we really set the bar when it comes to professional standards and professional training. We conduct annual trainings for state, federal laws that require us to do certain trainings every year, as well as the university. But we also have an accreditation team. So we're accredited by an organization called the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators. They have tripled the standards of New York State police accreditation, and that's who accredits us. And there's annual trainings that are required by that accreditation. Some of the topics we train on annually are community engagement, legal updates, first aid, CPR, diversity, lab safety, officer wellness, active killer response, and the list goes on and on about various topics. It's a pretty diverse list of training opportunities we have. Most recently, we hosted a de-escalation training for all law enforcement agencies in this part of the state. We worked with the Collaborative Reform Initiative Technical Assistance Center, a program that's part of the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Community-Oriented Police and Services, to fund and deliver training on de-escalation skills to take this agency to the next level of customer service. So if anybody's familiar with President Obama established a task force on 21st century policing, they came up with pillars of 21st century policing. One of those pillars was community engagement and training on de-escalation skills. So we were very proud that we could be the ones to bring that training here to Tompkins County. I'm hoping there's going to be a little bit of a press release on that, so there's some more information looking forthcoming. I was also asked to talk briefly about our crime stats. So our crime stats are always available online right at our police website, which is www.cupolice.cornell.edu. Here's a hard copy. I have a couple with me if anybody wants a hard copy. So we published the previous 3 years of crime stats. And so you notice that this one says 2017. That's because this one comes out in the fall of 2018. We get a couple months to get our stats together, submit them to the Department of Education, and then publish your annual security report. So 2018 will come out this coming fall. So you can always look here. In addition to the crime stats for the past 3 years, This also includes any crimes reported to other campus security authorities. So say an RHD were to learn of a serious crime from one of their residents, but they don't want to go to the police. But it's a crime that happened on our campus or in any of the geography that's identified here. We still carry that as a stat because it's important for our community to know what goes on around here. It's important for them to know that there are crimes that happen so they can take steps to protect themselves. Also in the campus watch, you'll find a list of all the services we provide and the services provided on campus. It's a good information book, and this is where I direct parents, especially when they come and they want to know, what do you do to help protect my son or daughter when they come to school here? So I just talk a little bit about what crimes we're seeing. Most common crimes we are seeing right now are frauds and larcenies. The frauds are taking the form of phishing email. So if you'll notice, Kathy's blue light message every week sometimes hit on phishing emails, and mine will probably be doing the same because it's pretty prevalent. Most recent are people that want to friend somebody and then engage in a online chat and get information from somebody and then try to use that information to basically extort the person that I'm going to release this information or these images if you don't pay me such and such. So we've seen a little bit of that. Sometimes they'll lock up somebody's data and try to ransom that. So we continue that message that we protect yourself from these online frauds. Larcenies, it's kind of a steady larceny here on campus. It's not horrible. One of the things I like to pride myself on is we have students that'll go to a library and leave their laptop. Not that we recommend that, but they do. And most of the time it is still there when they come back. And I think that's why people feel so safe. But unfortunately, every year at the end of each semester, we see an increase in larcenies. So you start seeing our messaging and our patrols geared towards areas where people leave their electronics hidden or out in the open, And that's where they end up coming up missing. And some of the locals that like to steal stuff, they know that. So we'll be messaging out to people to protect themselves. And we are expecting a little bit of an increase in larcenies over the next 3 or 4 weeks. So I cruised through everything that was on the ask and on the agenda that you asked. I'd be more than happy to take any questions from anybody.
Absolutely. So if you have a question for Chief, please raise your hand in black and I'll put on the speakers list. I actually just want to also note that I neglected to introduce Lieutenant Bellamy, who's kind enough to join Chief Honan. That being said, though, we've had privilege and pleasure of working closely with Kathy when she was chief. We're very glad to have you. And I guess I would just start off, I have Chris on the speakers list, but is there anything that this assembly can do to help you in terms of your goals or anything that in terms of publicity or anything else that we could do to help benefit you as you move forward and start selling as chief?
I think one of the biggest opportunities we have is to connect with our community. That's one of the things I led with is it's critically important for us to be connected with our community, to understand what the community wants, what the community needs, but also for the community to understand what our job is and how we do it. A lot of the complaints that we do receive is sometimes just a misunderstanding between the services delivered and people not understanding why we do it. But also sometimes it's us not understanding what the community is actually doing. So any opportunity to connect, I would appreciate. Certainly, if you never ever have a concern about delivery of services on campus, I would love to hear about it as soon as possible because we can take steps to correct it. I always have a supervisor on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So even outside of a setting like this, if you were to ever have a concern with our services, you can call our office, ask to speak.
That's it. Thank you. I have Chris first on the speakers list. Anyone else like to speak, please raise your hand or placard and I'll ask.
Thanks, Matt. You took my question, but I got another one. Congratulations, Chief. I was wondering if you could speak about the relationship between CUPD and the Ithaca Police Department, because Cornell is so prevalent everywhere, whether you're an employee speeding through the Wegmans parking lot and those kind of interesting situations, and what is that like from your perspective?
So it's a very good relationship. The area that we patrol covers many jurisdictions, so it's not just the city of Ithaca. It goes out into the town of Ithaca, town of Dryden, into Lansing a little bit, Village Cuba Heights. So we have a great relationship with the city of Ithaca. That's where most of our activity happens. We have trained with them in the past. We anticipate training with them again. We do the training that we just hosted. Ithaca Police Department was invited to and they did send some representatives. If we can collaborate on training, on cases, we do that. We have a MOU with all the local police agencies that in a major incident, we can help them and they can help us. Being that our jurisdiction is primarily Cornell, it does outline off campus, we are somewhat limited in what we can do, but we're still going to provide whatever assistance we can. Example is a major investigation, if they need investigators, I'll loan them investigators and they'll do the same for us. So if any people do interviews or help process a crime scene or anything like that, we definitely share those resources. In a small area like this, they're somewhat limited. Administratively, a great relationship with the chief, great relationship with the sheriff, chief of Cuyahoga Heights. We also interact on a regular basis with state police. Lieutenant Bellamy is my go-to person for state police relationships. He's got a very good relationship with the new commanders that just showed up. State police is helping us with commencement. That's definitely a big day for us and a nice change in the leadership here. They're going to be offering up some help. So it's very collaborative, both in training and on the road.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next is business.
I have Dale.
T, raise your hand.
Oh, T, raise your hand.
I did. I mean, I
don't know if you know the answer to this, but when interacting with students, have Cornell police officers ever found confusion on students about how the legal system on and off campus is different versus when Cornell police is responsible for reporting things to the judicial administrator versus local authorities or not? Because I know most students don't understand the difference between the campus code of conduct on campus and off campus. And I'm wondering if Cornell police has been able to note confusion on students in that regard.
I would say in my experience, I don't see a lot of confusion. Students that we would deal with are relatively clear that they're going to the JA versus a criminal court. We use the JA far more often than we use that criminal court, because most of the offenses that we're dealing with are very low level offenses. They're better adjudicated there. They're better handled on campus. I have had students that have been to the JA that don't want to go back to see the JA, and they will ask to go to criminal court. And for those students, it is clear which is which. So if there's something I'm missing here,
no, that helps. That's exactly it.
Yeah, I just haven't seen that.
Okay.
Hey, Steve.
Okay, so my question is very, it's an interesting question, but it's something that definitely has been on my mind for a long time since I got here as a freshman. So is it CUPD that say would shut down the party because of the noise complaints? Is that CUPD or is that Ithaca police? On a Saturday night?
So the question is where?
Okay.
So our shutting down of parties on a noise complaint is somewhat rare because there aren't a lot of large parties in our fraternities anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We do have some in some of the student unions,
right,
which usually are very well managed. So there's not a...
So the location or the geography where you do shut down parties is just limited to, it doesn't include College Town, for instance, and then the West Campus area.
So again, it's property specific. So it depends on where it is. So College Town, we have Sheldon Court.
Okay.
We have Skyler House.
Right. Okay.
That's about Cascadella Hall. That's about it right there.
Right.
But we will call if IPD has a very large party that's out of control. We'll go and we'll help with some traffic. We'll help back them up if they need it.
Okay.
But the actual shutting down of the party in College Town is the police department.
Oh, okay.
And the enforcement of the noise ordinance is the police department.
All right. Then my follow-up question would be for them.
Okay.
What about co-ops?
Co-ops, again, we have very few calls of co-ops. If they were a Cornell-owned co-op, then that would be us that would go.
And I think the police would never go there.
I can't say never, because if it's a large enough party, when I talked about our collaborative efforts, if it's a large call that requires a good number of officers because of the volume of people or whatever the reported disturbance or crime is, sometimes we all go. And then sometimes we also don't get a clear address from a complainant. So we get there and we'll find out, oh, it's not a Cornell property. It's a private residence. Ithaca Police, this is yours. We're here to help you out. We get to a Cornell owned, co-op, and it was, oh, this is ours. We'll take it. Ithaca Police helps us out. But I hope I answered that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. I have Richard, Linda, and Ashley.
So, a question regarding student events and security. So my understanding in the past has been that whoever is organizing a student event requests or doesn't request security, and then you accept that, or do you make an independent judgment? And the other part of this question has to do with who pays for it. Because one of the things that's come up is if you have a political event and it's declared to be controversial, then there's more security, which is more expense, which has the effect of discouraging speech. Mm-hmm. So those are the questions.
So you're almost right when it comes to special events, how it was. So how it was, and when it comes to security, we're the ones that do the recommendation of what security is and what's required for events. So just like if you're running an event, just like you have to contract for catering, you have to contract for an electrician, sound system, room, security is another aspect of holding an event, especially if there's an event that requires security or requires a law enforcement presence. We help make recommendations, and we're the ones that have to staff it. Sometimes we will try to help a group out if they can contract with a private security firm, which definitely has a little bit less cost than hiring officers. Sometimes we've had advisors, and we've had students that have stepped up and will take crowd management training. And you know, it's, you know, are we going to have somebody in the room that's going to be able to call if there's an emergency? So the heckler's veto is certainly a point that the university is taking on. We tried to come up with a plan that failed miserably last year. Tried offering some incentives to help financially for these larger events. The students were not happy with it. We held some listening sessions over the fall. We've been putting together this spring what we learned, and okay, what can we do to improve this so we don't have the heckler's veto? The Dean of Students Office and I are working pretty hard at getting that done. I can't tell you what we're planning just yet because we got to get the buy-in from senior administrators. So we're finishing up that plan to try to reduce, if not take out some of the security costs ourselves, so that's not a hampering, something that hampers free speech on our campus. I'm hoping I addressed your question.
No, thank you.
Hopefully within a couple weeks. Our goal is to have something out before the end of the semester, so students can help plan, because some of them got to plan now for their fall events. So we'd like to have them have that information so they know what to expect in the fall rather than come back and be surprised.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Linda.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm not sure if you have any jurisdiction over Seneca Place downtown, where all the Cornell, you know, there's 350 Cornell employees that work down there.
Yep. So we don't hold jurisdiction. We do, certainly if something happened on the floors at Cornell Patrols, we could. But as a matter of practicality, it doesn't make sense for us to have a police department that's responsible for a couple floors on a whole building. So most of the time it is the police department. We do consults. We do, if there's an incident, we get involved. But with our relationship with IP, or because we do have some jurisdiction, I might be able to help with whatever.
I'm just wondering who sets the security policies for the office building, because it's almost impossible to get in. We have these hotel key cards that never work, and they're out of them all the time. And so there's people just knocking on all the doors. I mean, I'm just wondering who's in charge of that.
So I'd have to check if that's on Cornell's system or if that is on the hotel system. Do you use your Cornell ID or do you have a separate card?
It's a separate hotel card.
I can certainly.
It's really, really funky.
That sounds different. But I can certainly follow up with that if you want to drop me an email, or we can after if you have a card. And I can certainly follow up on that and find out. We do, when they have security incidents down there, I do connect with some staff down there and I can find the answer for you. And if we can offer up any assistance with our crime prevention unit, there might be some assistance to help advise them, maybe to manage that in a more practical
way. I would just love to see it aligned with what's going on campus where you use your ID. I mean, it doesn't make any sense what they're doing down there. So that's why I was wondering.
Yeah, I was positioned to be involved in the design and how that was set up. So I don't know the details. But if you want to drop me a note, we can connect after and I'd be try to find an answer. It may not be the answer you want, but I'll at least have an understanding of how that's working down there, and if there's an opportunity, then I can help advocate for it.
The Terrell didn't get the as you would like.
Oh, it's Seneca Place. Okay. Yeah. You're welcome. I'm sorry.
From Ashford. To go back to an earlier discussion on your like work with IPD. So say a student has some sort of crime that would be referred to the JA on campus, but say they're in an off-campus location, like in College Town or somewhere not in your jurisdiction that IPD services. Does IPD usually refer that to you? And then that gets sent through the JA or like what's the connection here?
The campus code of conduct is applicable on Cornell property. So it's not applicable off property, with the exception of the JA can petition to have serious offenses considered. So if there was a very serious offense, in all likelihood, we would be partnered with IPD anyways, helping them out. We would have the information and we would pass off to the JA. If it was serious enough, the JA would then petition to be able to accept that case. And I believe she goes to the president to ask for that.
And I also had a second question, just on community outreach. I was wondering what kind of events CUPD has to like engage with students outside of just providing safety and security for student events. Do you have any like dedicated events to integrate yourself?
Well, we'd like to do more. Sometimes our staffing is prohibitive to that, but you can usually find us down Village Straight handing out popcorn. We have a popcorn with a cop. I'm not sure what they're calling it right now. And we look for opportunities like that. Our crime prevention officers try to get out to any of the tabling, try to connect there if there's opportunities for us to partner. Chief Zoner's certainly volunteered to have a pie in the face on multiple occasions. We'll see if that offer comes in where I'm going to stand on that. We're always seeking opportunities. So if anything comes up, certainly ask, and we would be more than happy to partner. Sometimes it's just as simple as officers on patrol, they see an event going on, they stop in, they say, hey, we're here, can we help you? Anything you guys need? And sometimes it's just that simple.
Thank you. Any final questions for Chief Hoder?
I do have one. This is about body cameras. I noticed that you were wearing them. I Googled it real quick and it looked like it took place January 16, 2017. And one of your quotes is that you think they're very valuable for using in training. And how often would you say a year does a training based on previous footage end up happening, do you think?
I'd say it happens almost daily. Because what I'm finding since we implemented this, that I have my officers going back and watching their own videos and going, wow, I didn't really mean for it to sound like that. So some of that self-analysis, that I have Lieutenant Bellamy who reviews on a somewhat regular basis when there's a complaint, a concern, a question about our performance. Sometimes that training will happen on the spot. If Lieutenant Bellamy sees something, he'll bring the officer in and say, hey, you really could have done this better. You know, make sure you're following this policy when you're dealing with this type of situation. As far as building them into bigger scenarios, and we've had a couple we've built into our regular classroom training, but we want to be careful not to embarrass the officer to show their video if it didn't go well. We love showing the ones that do go well. We've seen more of those than the ones that don't.
Thanks. That's really great to hear how active it is in view, even the self awareness aspect of it.
Yeah, that's something I thought may happen, but the self-reflection far exceeds my expectations. I was really impressed with it.
Please join me. We'll discuss your cameras.
Yeah, so we also did implement cameras in our cars as well. So if an officer's camera gets blocked or knocked off or anything like that, we also have cameras in the front of the cars to capture a different angle. But also we have cameras inside our cars. So if they question about what happens, if we were to arrest somebody, put them in our car, we can see what happens to it in the back of the prisoner compartment as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Rich. Please join me in thanking Chief Honan and Lieutenant Bellamy for coming in and answering our questions. Thank you very much.
Sure.
If any other questions that come up, please let me know. I'll be happy to pass them along. And we look forward to continuing to work with you in the years ahead. And congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Back into our agenda. As I mentioned earlier, we also have Ted Shealy and Leslie Meyerhoff here to talk about. I would ask that we move into that quickly as to respect their time. However, prior to doing so, I would ask if they need to center briefly addressing one action item for the day, the Judicial Codes Council confirmation.
Hearing no dissent, we'll move into that. So for those who were at our meeting ago, which is the weekly class meeting before the break, we are happy to have Marissa O'Gara here. She's the nominated to serve as usual codes counselor. She'll be taking over after Ryan Parker's current JCC, but then here's a, so she'll be JCC 2 years from now. Richard served as our representative on the search committee, and I believe you said you had no concerns with the ultimate selection. Correct, Richard?
Excellent selection.
Fantastic. So Marissa was here to introduce herself. That being said, we posted notice that she was going to be selected. We heard no comments. Are there any concerns, questions, or discussion prior to our voting on confirming her or not?
One was a mistake for him at this exact second until Linda gets back in the room.
Linda stepped out, yes.
And where was this posted? Because I didn't see anything about this.
My understanding it would have been posted in our meeting packet from last meeting and put on our.
Okay.
But I can double check with that. If we'd like, we can double check now or do so afterwards.
No, that's fine.
Well, considering that Linda stepped out, we actually are one shy of quorum. That is a slight wrinkle. In terms of respect for time, I would actually ask that we move into the beginning of the tobacco survey. We may jump out of that once Linda comes in to hold the formal vote because it doesn't need to get done today. But there's no dissent. I would actually welcome Ted Shealy and Leslie Meyerhoff, who's here to join us to talk about tobacco and tea also to introduce and discuss us on what the CIC or CWC has been discussing.
All right, so this kind of latest iteration of the survey actually hasn't gone through the entire CWC. It was freshly drafted on Tuesday, the help of Ted and Leslie. Thanks so much for that. It's much, much shorter than before. The main idea was to get information that would be especially germane to policy writing. And so we did slim a number of questions that were more so related to like Cornell Health and the kinds of interventions that they would do. And we thought that those questions could be asked, could be acted upon during the process if we eventually move into instituting a ban during the process of instituting that ban. Get all of that feedback on the health stuff. So this is the policy stuff. And I'll hand over to Leslie and Ted to kind of answer your questions and also just explain more so what went into this.
So I'll start.
Yeah.
We've had a couple of conversations with the CWC, and yesterday's was really focused on honing in on what is that you need to know. Dave was there, Charlie was there, T was there. Yeah. And because the original survey, has everybody seen the original survey?
I should have.
Okay.
So it was circulated, so in essence, we discussed it previously. So all members of the CWC executive committee have seen the original incarnation, and a number of members who were interested, I also shared it with them.
Okay. We don't need to talk about the original other than to say it was enormously comprehensive, and we were concerned that it wasn't going to get the kind of response that we needed in order to be able to make a decision about how to move forward. And so we really focused our conversation yesterday on what is it that you need to know. And so what you have in front of you, Ted revised it slightly since we sent it out, but essentially this is what we're recommending as an 11 question survey to try to get the pulse of the campus on tobacco use and whether student faculty and staff think that it would make sense to move in the direction of becoming. So
I did put the revised one online. If it's a bit.ly/UATOB survey, all lowercase.
So if you want to see the
revisions.
I can do a quick overview. On the first page, the only change is that it now is the question number 3 is now a matrix. And then Ted rewrote questions 9 and 10. You want to describe how you changed them?
So one of the things that had not been in the original survey, and as I was going through some other surveys related to attitudes or views on tobacco pre-campus. One of the things that I saw was that there was in that survey, and I also realized subsequently that in most surveys that I'm familiar with related to any kind of a tobacco-free policy, there is a question related to perception of harm from exposure to tobacco smoke. So I did put in a question from one survey and then revised it. So the one that's in the paper copy you have was from one survey, and then I found another question in another survey and thought that was better. So I believe the one in the paper survey says, does it harm me or does it harm others? And the other one that I found, which I replaced it with, was just a general, does exposure to tobacco smoke, is it harmful? So the question nine is, do you think that breathing smoke from someone else's cigarette pipe is A, very harmful to one's health, B, somewhat harmful, not very harmful, not harmful at all? So that was the revision. It's just it's broader, just talking about overall perception of harm, not bringing the individual particular status into it.
So I was thinking that you could, everyone could kind of glance through and basically tell us, give us feedback on what you feel would be instrumental, like what kind of answer, what kind of question you feel like would be absolutely important to have on the survey. So we voted on the fact that the survey is going out in the fall last week. So like we do have time to correct the survey. I know some, you know, there were concerns last week about how, you know, we're picking at the survey. Well, now it's 11 questions long from being 30. So like that's a huge, you know, that's a huge change. But there is time to improve on the survey. So this is not delaying just to allay your concerns. This process of, you know, reiterating the survey is not delaying the process in any way. Like the process is locked in for the fall, but this is just something that we're doing leading up to that. So just let us know like what you think needs to be on this, or what you think doesn't need to be on this and is currently here, or if you have broader questions about like community outreach, the conversation that we had the last time. These are the two experts that I have been, you know, speaking with that have been informing this process. So like, this is a good time to also ask them, because like there was conversations about like, why do we need to community engage in all of this? You can also direct such questions to them.
Thank you, T. So I have Richard, Linda, Ashwin, and Christopher on the speakers list. I just want to start by thanking T, Ted, and Leslie, as well as the whole CWC for your work on this. I know it's been a bit of a bumpy road as we've been moving this through, but I'm glad that we're finally moving forward. And also, based off the timeline of our last meeting, I'm glad that we're able to come forward and have this discussion. First on the speakers list is Richard.
So it looks like a very nice survey. I have a question about the instrument, whether you could add a question, an open-ended question that asks, has there been any incident involving tobacco smoke that you've encountered in the last whatever? The reason I ask this is because instruments always presume a reality in the questions, and that an open-ended question would be something that invites the respondent to adjust that impression of reality, that, you know, exceptional incidents and so forth, that then would help us understand more of what the context, texture of their experience.
So one of the things that I'm sorry, were you finished?
No, I'm done.
Okay. One of the things that we also talked about with Charlie yesterday was building a talk back forum on a website, so that and asking some fairly broad open-ended questions on this website to let kind of like what it was just announced today, the values statement, the core values. There's a way for us to respond to those core values on a web platform that becomes a discussion board. So this would be what Charlie is proposing is a way for that conversation to happen virtually, but in front of people, so they could see what other people are saying. And to probably start that long before we go into the process of doing the survey. And I think there are a couple of benefits to doing it that way. One is it gives people a chance to see how others are also thinking about it. And two, it removes it from doing the analysis of this, which will be pretty quick. But if we add a qualitative question, an open-ended question onto here, that would lengthen the time it would take for us to really understand the results, to be able to make a quick decision. That being said, you might decide that you want to have I'm not saying it's not a good idea. I'm just saying that part of the reason that it isn't on there in the open-ended questions is because we've talked about another forum for that to happen.
You have the same qualitative analysis of the website.
Yes, but that could start now and could be an ongoing conversation. I don't know what your time frame is for, you know, once the survey is done, how quickly do you want to be able to analyze the results and make a decision? So that's up to you.
Thank you. Next speaker is Linda.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm so glad to see this all moving forward. Hey, Ted.
Hey, Linda. Nice to see you.
I'm reading this and I really like that it's short. I don't know why we need 3 and 4. I don't know what a typical student is. I know zillions of them. I don't really care what people's perceptions of how much, I mean, we're going to find out by asking, you know, if you use phone. Like, I don't see the value in 3 and 4 knowing what people's perceptions of how much people smoke. I don't know why we need to know that. And so that was one feedback question. And then the other one was moving number 8 to be number 11, but I guess we get rid of 3 and 4, maybe number 9.
So moving it to the
because
end.
The secondhand smoke, you would think that 9 and 10, the questions about whether that bothers you would come naturally next. Then the question about should we consider becoming tobacco free, and then the question about if we did that, would you have been bothered to work here? I think that's a really great question, but it should be at the end,
yeah,
after we introduce the idea of that, and not in the middle of whether or not secondhand smoke bothers you. So I would just make it 9 questions, really straightforward, about personal experience rather than trying to guess what other people are doing. That seems,
yeah, so
I'm
the,
not sure why. Yeah.
So the idea, I think, behind that social norms question is because, I can quote you the numbers from where those questions came from. The perception is that any of these sorts of things, tobacco use, is much higher than it actually is. So, for example, this came from the American College Health Association National College Health Assessment. And in that, the question about cigarettes within the last 30 days, how often do you think the typical student at your school used cigarettes? So in the same question for did you use, the answer is for within the half last 30 days, did you use, how many times did you use cigarettes? It's like used daily, 2.4%. This is how much I did use. The typical student used daily is 16.5%. So the perception is that 1 out of 8, 7, whatever it is, students on campus are smoking daily. And the reality is that it's whatever I said, 2%.
So if you already know that, why do we have to ask? Like, why do we need that information in order to develop?
I guess maybe you don't. I think the value of it is that if it turns out that it's skewed, I mean, if you do a crosstab and you find out that there's a skew with the people who have a sense that there's that a high number of students are actually going to be impacted. And you know, over the years when I've been working, I mean, I was here 3 years ago and been in Ithaca College, and there can be an attitude that particularly among students you're going to impact, you're going to hurt my friends. I don't, it doesn't, you know, it's not me, but you're my friends are going to be impacted. And if that is something that that skews the results in one way or another, that may be valuable. So, I mean, I'm not going to fight for it, but that's the concept behind it as far as I'm concerned.
And those data are about students. We don't have the same data about staff and faculty, which this would be.
Right, right. You have the same in this. Exactly.
Okay, well, that makes sense. But again, if, you know, we're trying to keep it short, or,
yeah.
I mean, it's just feedback. To me,
yeah.
It seems
yeah.
odd because whenever I see a question like that, I don't know what a typical person's attitude is about any politics. I mean, what is a typical person? I don't know that, you know, so it's just such an odd question that.
Right. So the reason that a lot of, I guess, our conversations have kind of prioritized these two questions especially, and these are questions that we've taken out at some point and we've like brought back in because the initial reaction is like, I mean, who cares? This isn't really data that means anything, like, right? This is what people think about a statistic, not actually the
no.
statistic. But like when we're writing policy and trying to, or like writing the proposal, of course, you know, trying to interpret the results that we have at the end, like if we can say, well, I mean, this number of people said no, but this number of people also thought 90% of the campus was smoking when it's actually only 10%.
Yeah.
10%. So like that's the reason why we thought that this was like an important question to have so that we can understand. I mean, we can't fully understand why people will answer the way they do, but like we can make an argument about how, well, there is misinformation about how many people are smoking. Like, the results might be, you know, skewed towards this direction, as Ted was saying, because people think that there's so much more, you know, smoking than is actually taking place.
Thank you. I have Ashwin, Chris, Ashwin, Chris, Dale, and then Amani. Ashwin.
Yeah, so I like the distinction between 9 and 10. I think we should take that further. Establishing a tobacco-free campus, I think we should separate from establishing a nicotine-free campus because e-cigs, Juuls, other vape products have different side effects of secondhand smoke, and some people might perceive those differently. So I think if you separate question 11 into one that says a tobacco-free campus or specifically a smoke-free campus, specifically addressing cigarettes, cigars, and pipes, and a separate question that addresses e-cigs, vapes, or other products like that. That's pretty important because I think that's definitely something that'll hugely sway campus opinion on nicotine versus smoking itself and tobacco products.
So let me ask you this. Is it conceivable that we would create a policy that only focused on smoking products?
I think it could be. Because specifically taking out things that are established secondhand smoke, like dangers to people around individuals who are smoking that versus things that have just recently popped up that don't really have too many known side effects is like a distinction that a lot of people would make. So I think a lot of students would be far more supportive of a smoking-free campus or a tobacco-free campus than a completely nicotine-free campus, specifically because of the established harmful side effects there are, and also the, I guess, the smaller impact it has on, like, the whole student population and community population.
So I'm sorry, I got lost trying to find something. So you're saying to separate out tobacco-free combustibles from vapes.
Yeah, I think
okay.
That's
which
pretty important.
I think
number
be,
11.
Number 11. Yeah,
I think it'd be explicit that a vape-free campus is also a smoke-free campus.
So this raises a question that Laura Santa Cruz, who also has been involved in this process, has raised, which is, you all need to decide what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We can't make that decision for you in the form of this survey. So we've been, it's been a little bit. Trying to figure it out. So what is the language? What are we talking about? Are we talking about smoke-free, tobacco-free, nicotine-free? What is the free? And maybe what you're saying is it's not for this group to decide in advance. It's for us to offer options and let the campus decide.
Yeah, so what I was thinking is like specifically using the number, the language in number 11 to make a distinction between whether people are more inclined to having a combustible-free campus versus a broad nicotine-free campus, because I know some people might choose, they strongly want a combustible-free campus, eliminating cigarettes, cigars, pipes, but they're not opposed to having vapes and other those kinds of products on campus. So making that distinction of combustible-free, smoke-free versus nicotine-free completely.
Hey, Ted, do you want to respond to that?
So yeah, so I'll give you the public health, tobacco control, personal, et cetera, response, which is basically that we're talking nicotine here, and from a standpoint of public health, nicotine is a major source of addiction, and I think that if you're only looking at it from a standpoint of how it impacts me outside, if I'm bothered by exposure to secondhand smoke, then I think you're missing a lot of the reason for doing this. The social norms are changing, have begun changing based on exposure to secondhand smoke, as well as the fact that, tobacco, cigarette smoking kills half the people who use, as they say, kills half of those who use as directed. But now in particular, as the whole vape epidemic, it's been called an epidemic, manifests itself not only here in Tompkins County, but also nationally, at the same time as there's an opium epidemic and addiction has taken the place on the public stage in a way that it never has, because nobody worried about addiction to crack cocaine in the 80s because you just threw people in jail. Fortunately, that's different now. So from the standpoint of addiction, from the standpoint of what kind of a community Cornell, and you are representing Cornell, wants to establish, one where basically open use of addictive products is part of the social norm, I think you might want to take a look at that. I think some individuals would hopefully take a look at that, and hopefully with some of the educational efforts that would be undertaken, that would also be recognized. So there's that. The other side, and there's some other aspects of it which are, the more clear you can be, the better. So Cornell has had a 25-foot rule for many years, and I, many years ago, talked to the guy who established that 25-foot rule and sort of came up with the 25 feet. And it doesn't work because everybody's 25 feet is different. That's why if you say it's the property, it's the property. If you have a designated area, then it's property except designated areas, because it's not, you can smoke in designated areas, it's you can't smoke anywhere except designated areas. So you need to be very clear, and there is that fine line between somebody, and there's a lot of visual aspect to it. So if somebody is standing at this end of the plaza or the quad and sees puff smoke coming up from somebody and they say, wait a minute, I thought you couldn't smoke on campus. They're doing it, I guess I'll do it. That person's smoking a vape pen, this person's smoking a cigarette. There's that dichotomy. The other thing is that the idea of only smoking electronic cigarettes, the literature doesn't support it. So everybody's a dual user, not everybody obviously, but that's the majority. And you're not sending the message that I think is important to send when you're creating a new social norm that says public use of a highly addictive substance is not the way we're gonna have our community. Any more than, I mean, then open use of alcohol, or when it becomes legal, probably open use of combustible marijuana. So that's, you know, maybe too long an answer, but really, you know, the best practices, and this is the way that everything's going, is that you need to have it all. It's got to be tobacco. You're looking at tobacco. And nicotine, right.
My response to that would be that, like, as representatives, it's not our job to establish what we believe the social norm is. So considering that it's a survey, I think it's important to allow for the general community to establish what they want, like what the community wants the norm of the community to be. So including that as a question, allowing them to ask themselves a question of,
okay.
I
went off on my horse and made a statement, but yeah, all right. As long as you understand where I'm coming from, and so yeah.
Thank you. I would ask, actually, I know that one of our members has to step out a few minutes before the end of the meeting. Noting earlier that we do have to handle the JCC confirmation, I would ask if we could step out to vote on that. Is there any sense to doing so? Hearing none, we spoke briefly about the JCC. Marissa Ogara is our candidate. There were no concerns raised previously. I didn't hear any raised earlier in the meeting. Are there any final concerns about her candidacy to serve as the next Judicial Codes counselor? Hearing none, I have a speaker's list. Is there dissent to voting on Ms. Ogara to serve? Hearing none, all who are in favor of confirming Ms. Ogara to serve as Judicial Codes counselor, please raise your hand or placard. All who are opposed, all would like to abstain, the chair shall abstain. By a vote of 9-0-2, she is confirmed. I will command the president, bless you. That means that we can now move back into discussion on tobacco. And actually, just one thing to note on that. The assembly first examined going tobacco-free in the 2015-2016 academic year with then President David Skorton. Kathy Zoner actually was also coincidental at that meeting to provide an annual update. And she did note that her department at the time had concerns about their ability to enforce a completely smoking ban if we were to go in that direction. I mean, she prefaced it by saying that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it as a policy matter, but that from an enforcement matter, it would be difficult to be able to enforce it on a campus as large as ours with the current state of Cornell Police.
Well, and that's a common issue. Nobody really, you know, anytime I've been in a situation like this, there is a question about how you're going to enforce it. And I guess the answer is you do the best you can and you try and establish the norm. Whatever, again, here now going back to your comments, whatever the norm has, or whatever the norm is preferred to be, or you're trying to establish, then it's going to take a while. I mean, but if you don't start now, then you'll never get 10 years down the road when it's, so Yale, when I was working here, when I was at this table 3 years ago, Yale was supposedly the only Ivy that was going tobacco free. I looked on their website, they're still not there. It's still like, you know, they're fiddling along. And so really it's something that, again, you're right, this is what we're asking. But from my standpoint, it's like, if you're gonna do it, you do it all the way and you work out. I mean, there's a lot of things to work out, but that's sort of where the view is. And then it does get worked out over a period of time, which is why the question asks the 1 year.
Thank you, Ted. Next on the speaker's list is Chris.
So thank you both for coming today and helping with this. And thank you to the CWC for working on this. Going through the creation of a survey and questions is extremely difficult, especially when you're doing it with a committee and on such an important topic. I was in control of just making a poster for my own project and 45 opinions about where do I put the picture. So I can appreciate the work that you guys are doing. I'm a little bit towards what Linda was saying. I like the idea that question number two is what is your opinion of what is going on or what are your behaviors, and then juxtaposing that against question three and four makes sense to me about, like, what is the perception versus what are we measuring. with 3 and 4, the typical student thing, if I was taking the survey, I'd be like, I don't know, that's like 3 categories of so many people, I would just pick a random one.
Oh, so you would get, so it's selecting for what category you're in. So if you're in a, if you're a student, you'd be asked about the typical student. If you're an employee, you'd be asked about typical
employee. Specific to your population.
Okay.
Yeah, that, so it's not for different questions.
No. Okay, yeah. So that, that definitely makes it a little bit easier for me to understand that. I didn't understand that. What I was going to say, if it was, without knowing that, if it was a perception thing, there's an, possibly an opportunity to say, how many times a day do you see someone smoking on campus? How many times a day do you see someone vaping on campus? And then we're sort of like using their eyeballs about the perception, as opposed to, what do you think the random person is that, or, you know, well, not random, but like the typical person is? Because that, the profile of what is typical is maybe hard to wrap your head around, but what do you see is maybe, but that is just like a piece of feedback, and I don't want to get too hard into it.
It's, yeah, and in that situation, that's why we pulled it right from that other survey. I mean, that's the wording from that other survey. So I certainly see where you're going, but anyway, thanks.
Well, yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Next, I have Dale, then Amani, then Richard. Dale.
Yeah, I wanted to actually hear more of your thoughts on the editing of question 11. I think the big thing for us is that this is fundamentally not a referendum. This is really trying to get what does people think and how do we proceed from there.
Yep.
And for that reason, I'm a little confused as to why it wouldn't be helpful to know what the difference between public opinion is on vaping and Juuls versus cigarettes and cigars.
I don't think we're opposed to splitting it out. In fact, I was imagining that there's another way to ask the question, mm-hmm. that would give them choices.
Yeah.
Like, would you prefer this or this or this or all of the above or something like that? So I think we're open to looking at this question differently.
But I do want to be sure that the two of you don't think there's any harm in asking that. If the goal of anyone here is a smoke-free campus or not, or a nicotine-free campus,
is there harm
in asking the question?
I think there's risk in asking a question that you're not likely to pursue. Well, on any survey. So if you're asking a survey about, I'm trying to get a, we've done this before where, oh, so dining, let's use dining, Cornell dining as an example, and you've got a survey about Cornell dining and you're saying, you know, would you like handmade sushi every day? Would you, you know, and you've got 5 different choices that students can choose from, but you know that dining is not in a position to offer any of those things, but you ask it anyway. And everybody says, yes, I would love to have whatever the item is. And then we're like, yeah, too bad, not gonna do it. Is my question to you is this similar? So if we offer, if these are the different choices, that it could be combustible free, it could be vape free, it could be nicotine free, but the only real option is nicotine free, then we've set people up to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. And that's not fair to the community. And that's not the way that you want to be, that's not the relationship that you want to have with the community. So that was my question to push back. Are you willing to consider something other than nicotine free? And if you are, then I think it makes sense to break it out. If you're not, then I say no.
So for me, that is something that is a risk. But in my mind, there's no use to asking if people want handmade sushi. There's no benefit to that. But here, I think there is a fundamental benefit in understanding how many members of the community don't know that Juuls are just as harmful to the individual as cigarettes. Because we could realize that there is a serious lack of public knowledge of how harmful Juul use is from how people respond to that question, even though we're not asking it as a public policy decision-making question, which could mislead the public.
But they're going to think that that's what this is.
And Ryan, do I understand the risk there is misleading the public,
yeah.
But the possible gain is realizing how much more education we have to do on Juuls.
Well, and there is some in splitting out the perceived harm question,
mm-hmm.
that can also get at that, because the perceived harm question does ask,
right.
Perceived harm for mm-hmm. combustibles and perceived harm for vape aerosol. So
then I think I would prefer to split out the perceived harm question than the split out question 11.
Yeah,
so let me show you how it was rewritten. Or did you find it on
that? Is this it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you read it?
Yes.
For those of us who don't.
Absolutely. Do you think that breathing smoke from someone else's cigarette, cigar, or pipe is, and then the options are very harmful to not harmful at all? And then do you think that breathing smoke from someone else's e-cigarette, Juul, or other vape device is? What that doesn't ask, and this may be what you're getting at, Dale, is use.
Right.
Do you think that using cigarettes is harmful? And do you think that using Juul and other e-cigarettes is harmful?
And I think that's not exactly as helpful for where we go with policy, but I think it is helpful for understanding what the community thinks and knows.
So are you suggesting then that we put those?
I'm not sure if I want to suggest it. I think the committee's been following how many questions they're adding to the survey, but I think that might be more helpful than knowing, because I agree with the reasons that it would be a bad idea to split up question 11, and we don't want to mislead the public on that. So if there's room in the survey.
I think that there would be great value to having Laura and or others from Cornell Health perhaps see what their view is also. But my experience is that most people are not going to think that breathing the aerosol from a vape is harmful. Our answer to that, now you pushed another button. Our answer to that is we don't know. And, you know, for years and years, nobody paid attention to secondhand tobacco smoke either. There are studies that say, number one, there's nicotine. Number two, there's formaldehyde. Number three, there are some DNA splitting components of vape aerosol and that sort of thing. So, but, you know, my personal example of that is walking into a building and having somebody, I'm walking out, somebody's walking in, and the person is smoking an e-cigarette, and I go like this, and she says, "Oh, don't worry, it's just water vapor." And I said, "Water vapor," and I said, "No, it's not." And she said, "Yes, it is." And I said, "No, it's not." And that was the end of it. So I think that there is, the industry has pushed that it's just vapor, it's just water vapor. And so I think that that perception is that they're harmless. So I think you can potentially get, I think at your, you know, some response to your
And I think question. With that, I don't want to add any other questions.
So I actually have a clarification. Potentially, if you were trying to add another question, what exactly is it supposed to be?
I think question 9 and 10 on here do exactly what I wanted to do in that
okay.
case.
Okay.
So I think the revised Google document,
okay.
I don't know if Ashwin still agrees or disagrees on that.
I mean, it's basically the same as 9 and 10 now, but I mean, in the old one, but just like the wording is different.
Yeah.
Right.
My concern with that is that in 9 and 10, you're setting it up to be a question of public health, not individual health, whereas 11 is getting specifically, or through the arguments that you were making, is more of an individual health question. So I think we need to clarify before we write the whole survey if we're talking about banning tobacco use or nicotine or whatever it is for individual health reasons of the campus community or for public health benefit.
Yeah, you all need to decide that.
Yeah. So I think that's a decision we have to make, because that'll definitely shape what kind of things we want to do with the survey. Mm-hmm. But without splitting up the question of 11 and making it tobacco or combustible free versus nicotine free, you're still using that as an individual health question, whereas 9 and 10 are addressing a public health question. So as it stands right now, those two questions are addressing different things. Which are two different avenues we can take as a UA on what we want to address with banning nicotine or tobacco.
Well, what about when you think about question 8 in relation to that? So that's the one, if Cornell had a tobacco-free campus when you applied, how would it have affected your decision? That's more personal.
I think that just addresses the effect it has on kind of campus values. That doesn't clarify whether this decision's made to benefit public health or individual health.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you want that decision to be made and that to be
what's
informing
the
absolutely. That's part of why I keep saying, what is this about?
Yeah.
What do you need to know? What? Yeah, yeah, I agree.
So
and so I thought. Are you finished? I think if this is what we're doing, realistically, if we're doing it on the basis of individual health, I don't think many of the campus community will accept that as a viable policy decision, just because as a nation, that kind of norm has been established. But if we do it for a public health type of avenue where we're benefiting the general public health on campus, I think a lot more people would buy into eliminating combustible products that are harmful to others around them, not just the individual that's using it. And so if we want to realistically take a step forward in the right direction, I think we have to focus more on the public health aspect of it rather than trying to address or trying to kill two birds with one stone by addressing both individual health and public health.
Sorry. I do have a speaker's list. I have Imani, Richard, and Ashwin again. I just want to make sure, because I know Imani has been waiting patiently. Just to take a step back, though, the UA's history for this is that this has been kicking around, as I mentioned, for a number of years. It was supposed to be a survey, then a referendum, then a quasi-survey referendum. Now it's back to a survey. In essence, because I think to Ashwin's point and your point, there was a lot of uncertainty about what to do. It was, oh, do we ban tobacco? I think to Ashton's point, do you ban just things that deteriorate smoke and cause secondhand effects? Do you ban all nicotine? And I think the intent of the main survey was to go back and say, okay, we don't know what the community wants. We are going to ask the community what are perceptions such that we can consider the full spectrum, going from banning combustibles, banning anything that sets off a vapor or asking something else that's visible, to banning nicotine all the way. Obviously, I'm strong aware that many people have strong opinions on one side or the other, but the idea behind this was to say, okay, we don't have the data to understand what we want to do. And because of that, we're going to ask people for what their opinions are and then analyze that in context with questions. Obviously, it's a balancing act between getting enough data to decide on and also making sure people actually finish the survey. But that's the framing that the assembly has been putting forward in the past. We are, of course, free to depart from that, but I think it might be helpful in terms of that the assembly's prior statements have been that we want to collect this data so we can consider the full spectrum of options, and going in with minimal predisposition of we're trying to drive towards a goal, but rather we're trying to gather information so we can best determine us in the administration where we're going to go.
Right. So what I was going to say in response to like the conversation that's been had about question 11 is we could put like a disclaimer at the top, like question 11, or I mean wherever we'll want to put it, because there are some preambles like introducing sections. So questions 11 and 12 are about potential policies that will not necessarily like make it clear that those aren't necessarily policies that would be implemented, and then ask, and then separate, you know, between combustible and, you know, vape and stuff. So it's not leading the community astray, but at the same time, it's getting that finer grain information. I feel like that's something we could talk about.
If you're willing to split them.
Right. And that's, I guess that's something.
Yeah. We talk
about. Thank you. Next is Imani.
I have two questions. The first question is about the first question, question two, especially where it says used daily in the last 30 days, is that the assumption that if someone checks that box that they're a long-term smoker, rather than asking the question in terms of how long a person has smoked? Only because as you're getting opinions for people, especially staff members, you do have staff members who have smoked quite a long time. And so knowing that information compared to knowing just the last 30 days, I guess what would be the better option?
I think that's a good question for staff and faculty, more so than for students. These questions we already ask students. And so they're familiar with these answers, and many of our students haven't been legal long enough to smoke more than 30 days. and so that's part of the reason. And these are American College Health Association questions. I think it might be different for staff and faculty, but it might not. I actually don't know. Do you have an opinion, Ted?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure that I fully, I think I got what you're asking, but would you just, or maybe you can explain it.
Well, I'll let Imani speak.
I guess looking at this and looking at it from a staff perspective, would it be more beneficial to get a sense of how long someone has smoked rather than just getting information if they smoked in the last 30 days?
Okay.
I guess I was trying to understand what you were trying to get in that question. Would an assumption be made that if they smoke daily in the last 30 days, are they a long-term smoker?
Yeah, I think that the general prevalence, the prevalence question is a 30-day question. And I think if you're trying to find out sort of how many people are smoking now, then it's a 30-day question. You can ask, I mean, a smoker, the CDC defines a smoker as somebody who has smoked at least 100 cigarettes in their lifetime and smokes now some days or every day or some days. And if you've smoked 100 cigarettes in your lifetime and you don't smoke at all now, then you're a former smoker. Is that valuable? I don't know. I think from the standpoint of this particular situation, the benefit of finding out who is smoking now, who is a current smoker, which is a 30-day question, is to a certain extent, what are we going to have to gear up for when this, if/when this goes into effect? So how are we going to help people get through the day if they are a current smoker? How are we going to help people, you know, whatever? So I believe that would be the benefit of asking it now.
Okay, so I guess another question would be in regards to 11, and I think this may have been talked about before, but where it says, given the options, would it make sense then to have a space for optional Y? And the reason why I say that is because, so let's say I'm a smoker, and you're asking me this question, but I strongly disagree. But there's not an opportunity for me to say why. You know, I could, if there was an opportunity, I can say, well, then what resources would be available to me to cope with, you know, not being able, to smoke, you know, especially if I have a 15-minute break, you know, but I've been smoking for 10, 15 years.
Right.
So I guess the question 11 would there be opportunity for an optional be able to explain?
Right. So the previous version of the survey did have questions about cessation, and there was there one that says, would you seek cessation services or help? I mean, in that situation, somebody may not want to quit, but they may want to seek assistance in some manner. So, I mean, I guess that question could be reintroduced.
I feel like this goes back to that website and that, you know, conversation, online conversation that we'll have. And also, like, I mean, there was the initial push for having in-person also community engagement, like through town halls, asking people, like, you know, what would you like to go along with the ban if it happened? Like, how do you feel about, like, you know, tobacco and e-cigarette use in general on campus? But I think we're straying away from the public, the actual in-person forum, and going to the website thing. So I feel like maybe just online, we could have it somewhere on the survey that, like, please, like, if you have any other comments, you know, follow up on the website. But I feel like it is really important to know why, I think, because that helps us, right? We are.
How does it help you?
I mean, we are concerned with what the community thinks. And we do want to, like, write a policy or a proposal to President Pollack that says, like, we recommend this, and we also recommend that Cornell Health, you know, is involved in this way, or, like, this other thing is recommended. Like, it's important to have, like, a humane face of a ban as well, because, I mean, we're not just, like, we're not, like, cold, you know, we are humans, and so those things would be in the policy writing process, but I don't think it necessarily has to be on the survey, especially to the point of, like, having a qualitative question that's more difficult to analyze. So we could link the website on here.
And I guess the only reason why, I understand that you're not creating policy, you just want to get in, but I was a former smoker. I used to work here, but I still work here, but I kind of feel that it may eliminate people who do smoke, who may not respond to the survey, especially, I guess my concern, I understand that the public health concern, because I know, even though I was a former smoker, when I walk past people who smoke, it bothers me. Yeah, I understand that, but there's also the reality of it, and I guess speaking from staff who, okay, they've been smoking for a number of years, you know, and let's say because their voices were not heard, it was like the majority, we want a smoke-free campus, so we moved to a smoke-free campus. But then those people who do smoke, what happens kind of to them if we're saying that nicotine, folks and nicotine tobacco is this addictive thing. And so how does that impact during their job or when they take a break, you know, or what kind of discipline falls on them?
Well, I think that if I can just jump in, I think that one of the things that was mentioned in the CWC meetings that I was able to go to was aspects particularly of some of the staff and making sure that there was opportunity for them to voice. So there was for the dining staff, what was the thing that dining staff has for training at a particular point in August or something,
yeah.
And there was discussion about making sure that there was opportunity for information and ideally discussion. So, you know, one of the things that had been brought up at some point was the idea of town halls and other. I mean, my experience is it's incredibly valuable to be able to get people together so that the people who do smoke can ask the questions, and the people who don't smoke or who bothered by smoke can explain their side of it too. So that interaction is incredibly important, and I guess it would be a valuable opportunity to be able to have settings where the staff, who particularly those who are not connected to computers, would have an opportunity to voice their concerns and ideally have some of those concerns addressed.
The other thing we talked about, Imani, is Cornell Health has offered to do some marketing around information about smoking, whether it's social norms or cessation, you know, tools and that sort of thing, in collaboration with this project. So this is not the only interaction that anybody is going to have with these questions. It's ideally going to be a larger conversation that goes beyond the UA and includes, you know, other parts of campus who are working on this topic.
Thank you very much. I have Richard left on my speakers list. We are running low on time, and I know there's a strong desire to have a discussion about budget planning after this. So I would ask Richard to try and be brief, and then we can move into that. And then other questions can be handled offline or via email.
So two things. I really agree with Ashwin's point about public health as opposed to individual health. I think that's a good point. The second thing is question 7, which I think is a little too narrow. When I walk through campus, I'd make that, have you been exposed to secondhand smoke or vape aerosol when on campus? So that includes dorms, that includes buildings and so forth. Walking on campus, I mean, people are going to interpret that narrowly. Did I have a breakout for that? If they say rarely, sometimes, often, always, where? Dorm, classroom, workplace?
We had that list before and we took it out. How would it help you make a decision?
Because they're going to be hot spots.
Let me actually just add on to that really quickly. So there was an issue that had two parts. So it's like the fact that dorms and inside buildings are already banned, like, so smoking is already disallowed there. So there would be two things that it would be asking. Like, if you're asking both inside and outside, it would be asking both how is this enforced and also how, like, you know, what is the effect of the rule in general. So it's like conflating two things there. Like, if we will ask for both inside and outside in the same question.
Here's the problem. I've worked on this campus a long time. I've never run into somebody smoking.
What? You've never walked past Trillium?
Never. I guess when I walk past Trillium, then nobody's been smoking. it never happens. So what I'm curious about is the hotspots where there is this interaction, and regardless of whether it's enforced or not. So whether it's a dorm and somebody's smoking in their room or, you know, whatever. It's just that it's an information question about where are the hotspots where people are smoking that other people who are not smoking run into it. Just that's the reason for the breakout, not for enforcement, not for anything else except for information about where they're encountering it.
Okay. So my question back is it a need to know or a nice to know? As we're trying to keep it short.
No, I understand. Yeah. I think it is a need to know in the end when we come to enforcement. If there are really just a few hot spots, you don't need university-wide enforcement. Mm-hmm. You need particular, you know, regulations for those spots, and then also accommodations. So if there's really a hot spot and people don't have anywhere else to smoke, then you provide a space for them. So I do think it's a need to know. And it's directly applicable to policy.
I guess I can go either way because I've seen surveys both ways. But as far as, you know, where the hotspots are, my guess is if this goes forward and if it is determined that a committee is going to be put together to establish this policy, and there is three semesters or whatever worth of time devoted to it, and a ton of publicity ideally moving into that, that the hotspots will be shifting and some of them will go dormant, and it'll be totally different by the time that all happens, so that any information that you collect now related to hotspots, and my guess is that probably probably people know where the hotspots are. Probably the staff supervisors and, you know, and grounds people know where the hotspots are because they have to clean up the cigarette butts and so forth. So I could go either way, but it's a response to knowing today where the hotspots are today compared to where they'll actually be as a policy might take effect.
Thank you. That exhausts my speakers list. I want to thank Leslie and Ted for taking the time out of their day to come here and answer these questions. There's one thing I just want to note in terms of, this was brought up in the old survey, but even looking just briefly on this version, questions 8 through 10, the idea of that there may be a need for a question or disagree. For instance, 8 is, in essence, if Cornell's tobacco for you when you applied, would you either been more excited, less excited, gone elsewhere, or don't know? There is an option for someone who's just having different, or even number 9 and 10, where it's, I'm concerned about the health for myself or others. Well, conceivably someone could be, I'm not concerned at all. And just to allow the ability that if someone disagrees fundamentally, it's, well, is Cornell's tobacco free or not, it's not relevant to, or someone doesn't think it's relevant to them, to potentially have that option. But just an idea that you may wish to consider.
They all have that option.
Pardon?
They all have that
option. Oh, the new one does? Okay, I'm probably the hard copy one. Thank you, Dale. And thank you again for taking the time out of your day to come.
Thank you very much.
Please continue the conversation over email, and you're welcome to the CWC meetings every Friday at 11 a.m.
Thank you, Tia. We really appreciate your time and effort on this. That brings us to our last item for a few minutes we have left regarding budget planning. For those who know, this is something that's been on the UA's radar for a number of years. I spoke to Charlie last meeting. He followed up some faculty. He actually sent an email, I believe earlier today or yesterday, outlining a potential way to move forward with that. In essence, it was, actually, Charlie, do you want to outline it or shall I go over it?
So all things considered, and I can give details, the best thing to do is to create an ad hoc committee on budget planning for next year. I'm willing to chair it. We'd have two selected by SA, two from EA, two from DPSA. Over the upcoming year, we'll arrange to have FPC meetings where that group would be invited, or subsets, depending on what the topic is. And we would also produce a budget model user's guide that the average person can understand. At the end of the year, we'll have experience, plus hopefully a very useful document that will educate the campus. And at that point, we can decide whether or not UA creates a new standing committee, or whether the FPC creates designated seats, or whether maybe there's some third option that we discover.
Thank you. So that's something that Charlie proposed. I want to ask for general thoughts and feedback on that. Linda, do you want to speak?
Yeah, I really like this idea. The only piece that I would add is, because the UA has to make a decision on this at the end of the year, it seems relevant to have a few representatives from UA. so that they're actually there, so it's not just you providing, you know, so it would be entirely on you to provide feedback.
Yeah,
so it makes sense to have, you know, two members from here as well. And the more people who participate, the more of a voice we'll get on whether it was effective, how effective it was, how to move it forward.
Sure.
So I think that's a great solution. I love that it's real, that we can do it. And thank you.
Fantastic. So in essence, in terms of, assuming there are other comments on that, but if that's something the Assembly wishes to do, I can work with Linda and Charlie to draft. It wouldn't be an ad hoc, because ad hoc's only can last a year. It'd be a special committee. Functionally, there's really no difference. We would write a resolution, introduce it next meeting, pass it at our final meeting. We could potentially consider who we're going to appoint. I will inform our constituent assemblies as well that this is our seats going to set aside from them, so they can begin the process of staffing. I know the SA and GPSA do their staffing at the end of the year. With the EA, it's a little bit different because they're here year-round. But we will, in essence, can ensure that that's codified and passed and done prior to the conclusion this year. It would need presidential approval because it's an internal matter. Obviously, we'll work with the administration to make sure that those individuals are read into the confidentiality requirements. That being said, though, are there any other comments or concerns about that as a method of moving forward so that we have something done by the end of this year that can begin functioning next year?
What's the committee name again?
The committee name.
Well, the current faculty committee exists.
Yes,
which is the
so T, for essence, right now there's a faculty Senate committee that looks at the budget.
What's the name of that
committee?
Financial Policy Committee.
Yes.
Okay. There's also, when I look at Resolution 7 from last year, you also had on there benefits. There's a defunct committee on benefits that hangs off the Senate.
So in essence, the faculty Senate has the FPC on that. Then we would, in essence, be creating a special committee that would work next year, that would meet with the FPC, in essence, create a document just detailing how the budget works generally. And at the end of next year, it would be a retrospective saying, did it work to have a separate group? Should the FPC create more seats? Should we just create an entire separate committee? I can tell you from meeting with the administration, their preference was, in essence, to have one set of meetings. So instead of having to meet with the FPC and then our group, conceivably that could be solved if they always held joint meetings, or if we had seats on one or the other. I mean, there's multiple ways to ensure that we only have one set of meetings for the administration's sake, but that was the concern raised by the administration. But the idea here is FPC exists, we create a special committee, they meet together during next year.
And I just want to be clear, on occasion.
Correct.
Yeah, because the FPC feels that there are occasions when they want just university faculty in the room to discuss certain sensitive issues and so on. So it would be, if the topic comes up like, how do dollars flow to master's programs, graduate student stipends, how do you figure out financial aid, that kind of stuff. But there are other things, so it's not a blanket thing. It's like,
meeting our resolution to detail that. That being said, is there anything else? Yeah.
Just the usual question on the status of getting an updated version of the UA bylaws posted.
I will make a note. I'll talk to you after, but I won't make a note. Look at that. Thanks for reminding me.
I actually had a last thing. So I made the timeline that we had asked for in the last meeting for the getting the tobacco survey out in the summer for employees, or some employees, and then in the fall for the larger campus. So if you have any, I know we're out of time, if you have any feedback, questions, just let me know. You can email the general, I think everyone can email the General Assembly.
So yeah, everyone can email the UA members list, that is correct.
Okay, great. So you can email that. You can email me personally at tmo53@cornell.edu.
Do we need to formally approve this?
I don't know. We don't have to.
In theory, we can, if we want to formally approve it, we can approve it at our next meeting. But otherwise, I think
we should formally approve it.
We can't right now.
No.
Not now. At the next meeting.
Right.
But I do think it's important to have formal approval.
Oh, yeah.
So that it's on the record that we your time frame.
Thank you very much. With that, we are below quorum and it is past 6. The time is 6:02. The meeting is adjourned.
Woo!
Good job, Chairperson D.
Yeah.
You can ask him, yeah.
I am.
Thank you, John. I was just playing around.
Friday, that's Friday. That's Friday 4. Friday for Frank. Where they're about bringing those forward. I know they are currently in the process of writing them down. I mean, it's tight because Michelle's term ends of June 30, July 1, whatever.
Okay.
In essence, if there's nothing done by then, she automatically ceases to be JA.
That question about hot spots.
Mm-hmm. So they're currently being
right,
run
so
down that
just
regard.
Like,
so
I have
not
some questions.
I know Kelly was since you get back to him and she's still writing them down.
The larger survey wasn't
so.
Circulated.
I don't hear anything towards the end this week. I'm going to follow up and ask where we're at with that. Because it has 2A meetings left, so depending on what we're going to do,
but like
going to,
the question, the survey before had a question exactly.
It's really possible. Yes,
actually
yeah.
Have two questions.
They need to know that.
And two more points earlier.
Wait,
first,
no, then
that's
I have
that's
I have this question,
Kelly.
Like,
long conversation.
Wait, which
no, not
follow up. I don't hear back by the end of
the
week.
That's
insane that we have 2A meetings left.
Policy 6 point whatever.
That's or the input instrument. Either way, the J has to be confirmed by us, whether that be Michelle sticking around. Or an interim,
so,
or you're picking someone else.
And then there was a whole matrix around, you know, those hotspots, inside, like dorms, like parties, you know, libraries.
It allows an interim
there was
to be
matrix.
Appointed.
And then there was a second
essence,
question
so
saying,
the choices
all right, outside
the
eyes,
and us are,
keep the
reason
no from jurisdiction
yourself.
Policy outside.
Find someone new and reason from something brand new. Or say we're gonna do research again, we're gonna do something else. We can't make it by the end of the year.
You know,
we have an intro.
That
intro
would
have to
that
also
would be
the
new
by
aspect,
us.
Right? That's what the ban would be affecting because the ban wouldn't affect indoors because there's always been a ban indoors. And so I think that's why they prioritize that question. But you would still want to ask about.
I mean, I can all
understand.
The hustle.
Like the
matrix. Mainly because. And say, yeah, outside your home spots,
or
you know,
going beyond what his open authority is.
The problem is,
there was a question about very odd
and
strange language to interpret.
So,
I can write that down and communicate that.
Contrary to the
common because that is something that we've had.
And there also were concerns.
And it's kind of sad that we're doing like that.
How do they interact with the larger community? There are specifics. Example,
that's
I'm happy to
done.
I've never said a time to actually talk through it. It's about a half hour, 40 minutes to go through it all.
No, of course
because
it's not.
But they
yeah,
were, there
yeah.
were a number. I've heard into our multiple concerns from multiple
I mean,
people who don't know
like
each other.
It shows that you know.
And I've spoke to
I mean, it's always great to get
the
second
who
opinion.
Who corroborated that,
like,
such
why
that
it
raised the
rose
to level that I informed President Paul about it. I had a call with Kelly and the chief staff. Friday, and then Mr. Schuster is currently doing their digging on it. But you absolutely have a right to be privy to it. Kelly was said that she was bringing them to you. I'm happy to sit down and read you in on everything I know.
I think Kelly.
We'll see how like, the larger committee feels.
Yes,
how
well, I know, but right now, yes, that. She doesn't say that's going back.
Yeah, there's some strong opinions.
The committee.
Right, yeah.
My understanding is right now they're running out what they can find.
Like,
in essence, though,
prioritizing because
for
a lot
point
of
that,
questions are important.
In my experience,
like, if it's an
I don't
11,
believe
10
that
questions
you know,
would
be confirmed that the Insurance Republic
yeah.
should be brought back
no,
to
the
committee for the assembly, which is what I informed the administration of. Is one of the detail. I'm happy to have time to sit down
and
all the details we have because there's a lot there.
Right. The thing is,
timing
though, like,
is getting
people
tight
have
because
to these
need to make a decision
like, most
within the next. I mean, we have 2 weeks until today to make a decision, put them in on our agenda. We could hold special meetings.
We have no
that's not
yeah,
ideal
we
for a
we
lot
we
of reasons,
no.
but we might
like,
find
like, there's no
that's a
why can't
if we have 60% of and people also think 50, half of the people on this campus smoke.
You absolutely can, but that doesn't cut up any ability for anyone from the public to come. And that's why I said we have the ability to do so. Historically, we don't do that for reconfirmations or reconfirmations.
Because
we
took it out.
Can
like,
get comments. It happens very rarely that we do occasionally get someone who says, oh,
no, but truly, like,
this
is,
this is,
when I read these two questions the first time.